Hello, 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 and welcome back to Behind the Walls of the World Psychiatric Hospitals. I'm your host, Dr. Sarah Gallup, and today we have a very special episode for you. I have my first guest on the show. Very excited to have Nate Buchanan of Erie Tours at Airedale Hospital with us. Hi.
Good afternoon. Hello.
Hello. I forgot to ask you, what should I call you, Nate, Nathaniel?
Nate's fine.
Nate's fine. Great. Okay. So I'm really excited to have you with us. I know that you've been listening to the episodes on Airedale, and I thought we would just get started. There are a lot of things that people don't know about the ghost tours and what's going on. So I thought we could start, tell us a little bit about your background. How'd you get started doing ghost and paranormal tours?
Yeah, I started off life as a history teacher, and I graduated. I went to London, as most fresh university graduates do, and was working over there. And a friend of mine finished working for a company called Contiki. She just finished a tour. Uh-huh. And I was having a beer with her in London and talking about it, thinking that it sounded like it would be more fun to be a tour guide than a high school teacher, and applied and got the job because I was a high school teacher and became a different kind of teacher, walking around Europe as a tour guide. And I did that for 2 years. And at the end of that, I'd had enough of that. It's a hard job, very taxing on the body. Mm-hmm. And I still wanted to be involved in tour guiding. I didn't want to go back into a classroom. But over the 2 years I've been working with Contiki, I've taken people to a lot of different places, and a lot of beautiful places like Paris and Rome and Greece, the Greek islands. But we always took people to some darker places as well. When I say dark, I'm talking about, that have a history of tragedy and death, and lots of battlefields around Europe, and lots of castles and such, crypts under Paris. Every Contiki tour went to one concentration camp. So I have worked as a guide at three, being Mauthausen, Dachau and Auschwitz.
I've been to two of those three.
Yeah, magnificent history, aren't they? As a tour guide, it's a real honor, because most people don't get to be a tour guide at a concentration camp. And to tell that story with sensitivity and historical accuracy is a honor. And when you affect your customers, it's an intense experience. And it was an excellent teacher. Not that I'm suggesting that we should do ghost tours in concentration camps, but it was my first sort of toe into what we call dark tourism.
Yes.
And dark tourism is the tourism of death.
Yeah.
And when I finished there. Sorry?
There's a lot of hard things, of course, that happen at the concentration camps, and you feel that sort of negative energy when you're there.
Yeah, absolutely. And I don't think that a ghost tour would ever be appropriate at a concentration camp like that. Yeah. But dark tourism, ghost tours are a form of dark tourism, and dark tourism are bigger than ghost tours, because you've got cemetery tours that are history tours. You've got things like concentration camps and battlefields and such. They're not concentrating on the paranormal, but they're still focusing on the death. Right. And that is what dark tourism is. And that's what I became interested in.
Great.
So when I finished that, I went back to London, worked for a while doing the Jack the Ripper ghost tour, which was great fun. Went up to York and did the ghost tour up there for a while. Finished in Edinburgh doing the ghost tours under the Mary Queen's Close up there. Came back to Australia. There's a place in Australia that's fairly well known called Port Arthur. I don't know if you've heard of it, but some of your listeners in Australia would know it. It's the old secondary penal colony for the British Empire down at the far end of Port Arthur, and it was the hardest prison in the British Empire in the mid-1800s. And I lived there on site for 7 months, which was great fun and great experience. Cutting a long story short, I moved to Ballarat because of a woman. Saw Airedale by accident. Mm-hmm. And the first thing that went through my head, as you said in your episode and as said in the book, is that's the best ghost tour ever. It took me 3 years to get the keys. Yeah, I just went, wow, lunatic asylum. This massive, abandoned, labyrinthine, cobweb-covered, disgusting creepy as building. I was just like, oh man, this is perfect. This is custom built, and they even put lunatics in it for 60 years, and I'll use the term accurately. They even put lunatics in it so that we've got good stories to talk about.
Yeah.
So for me, it was just, oh man, that building is sitting up on top of the hill doing nothing. It's, for me, it was a massive tourism attraction waiting to happen. No one else saw it like I saw it. 3 years after I first encountered the building, I had enough credibility from doing street tours in Ballarat to approach the current owners. I was very lucky. The representative of the current owners at the time, the current owners being the TAFE, the Polytechnic, mm-hmm. was a former history teacher who came from Ararat. His parents had worked there. He was concerned that it was sitting up on the hill rotting as well and wanted it seen turn into a tourism attraction as well. And he gave me the keys. And
wow,
I was just the right person at the right place at the right time, because thousands of people had asked by that stage.
That's so amazing. Were the day tours going on by the time that you got there? And what time frame are we looking at? What year did you get there?
That was 2010 we got the keys. The day tours had been going on for a little while prior to that. Jay Ward's focus at the time, though, was more on Jay Ward. And since we've started doing the ghost tours at Arrowdale, they've pumped more effort into promoting Arrowdale as well. But for them, it was a bit of a side issue, whereas now it's probably equally as popular as their Jay Ward tours.
Okay. Do you do both of the tours or just the ones at Arrowdale?
I just do Arrowdale. I just did night tours. So Jay Ward's still owned by the Friends of Jay Ward, a largely voluntary organisation, largely made up out of former staff from Jay Ward and Arrowdale. So they have their own agenda, their own message they wish to convey, and their own spin on things that they wish to spin, which at times can be complimentary, but at times it's caused a little bit of frustration. But we do seem to move forward, and I think that both the day and the night tours are really important, because yes, I am biased. Yes, I do focus on the death and the grimness of the lunatic asylum, but that is only one side. And so it's nice to have that other side of it being discussed during the day. I think that they complement each other nicely.
Absolutely. To get that history and the sense of what life was like for people there. And then you're covering the sort of the grim history and the after death or afterlife part.
Yeah.
Yeah,
really, most people, I mean, when people think of lunatic asylum and they think of ghost tours, the first thing that pops into their head is lobotomies and straitjackets, and mm-hmm. that's because of social media and popular culture. So I am harnessing those images to create the scene. You know, we do focus on the treatments a lot.
Right, and that's great. I mean, I was able to talk about some of those treatments in the episodes on Arrowdale, and obviously it's a mixed bag. There were some things that worked really well and some things that really did not work very well. And that's, you know, I think it's equally important to look at both sides, the things that worked well and the things that completely failed and were inhumane.
Yeah, I'm not sure exactly which ones work so well. I mean, 1800s, your main port of call when it came to treatment was restraint. That theory continued well into the 20th century, and when it ceased to be mechanical restraint, i.e. straitjackets, it became your surgical restraint, i.e. your lobotomies, and then it became your chemical restraint, which is your largactyl and your chromosome. And I still wonder, now that the asylum is shut down, whether you know, chemical restraint still plays an enormous role in our community outside the asylum?
That's a good question. I mean, we still, technically, if you're thinking about it in terms of chemical restraint, every hospital, at least in the States, is still using it to a certain extent. We have backup medications that we can give if somebody is having problems. And one of the hospitals where I worked called it a B52, you know, that's the Haldol, Ativan, Benadryl trifecta. And that's something that will, if somebody's having a manic episode or just a lot of psychosis, can calm them down pretty quickly most of the time.
Yeah, sure.
And that's essentially chemical restraint.
And I wonder how much, I mean, I'm not a psychiatrist, I'm a historian and a student, but I see things like antidepressants or tranquilizers, which I think maybe perhaps being overused in society. And I wonder if that's a form of like milder chemical restraint, a slower form, but nonetheless a form of control as well. I guess I've become a bit cynical of psychiatry as I've studied it and looked at the history of the asylum, and I see that psychiatry is very much a two-edged sword. And on one hand, the psychiatrist is trying to help the person deal with a mental condition, and on the other side, I see that it is about control. And in a lot of ways, psychiatry have invented a lot of the mental conditions that they are diagnosing and treating in the first place. So
that's a complicated question. And certainly as a psychologist, you know, I don't work on the medical side of things and the medication side of things. But there's probably some validity to that. I do see some medications in general being overprescribed. It seems like, at least in the States, everybody has ADHD these days.
Here too. And I'm like looking at it going, hang on, none of these people would have ADHD if they didn't go and get a diagnosis from a psychiatrist. I'm like, what's going on here? You know, maybe have we all got ADHD? Maybe.
Right. And I always think about it, and I always tell my patients, and I know we're deviating from Airedale for a little bit. That's okay. You know, I always tell my patients that when somebody's experiencing depression or anxiety or grief, the first things to go offline are attention and concentration. And it can look a lot like ADHD. So when people are under chronic stress, when people are suffering with like a chronic low-lying depression, the symptoms may mimic ADHD a lot.
Absolutely.
And so it's interesting how that works. I could talk all day about that.
I'm totally with you. Like even physically, at the moment, I'm suffering from acute tendonitis in my Achilles tendon on my right heel.
Oh no!
I am having difficulty concentrating on just my fiance having a conversation with me at times. Yeah. I don't have ADHD. I'm in pain, and you know the symptoms can look the same.
Absolutely, yeah. And I think that gets overlooked quite a bit in terms for a quick fix. So it's interesting too, looking at the history of psychiatry and you know, the psychiatric facilities, and seeing what they know about what they knew at that time about psychiatric disorders and how they treated them, and then see how that morphed. You know, it's easy to look back and say, "Oh my gosh, they knew nothing," but then at the same time, we could look today and say we've learned so much more since then. And there's so much more left to learn.
Absolutely, yeah. And that's the same thing. Yeah. I totally agree where you came from. We're built on the knowledge of our ancestors and our predecessors. And I had a sad story. I was having a beer with one of the staff members one night down at Airedale. It was actually in our out at the pub. He's now the pub owner, one of the pubs. And he looked at me and he said, "Man, if you ran Airedale today like it was being run in the 1960s, 80% of the staff would be in jail."
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
He said that, yeah, he said that the staff in the 1960s and 1970s just treated the patients like guinea pigs. That's coming straight out of a former staff member's mouth.
Yeah.
And I look at it and think, okay, that's atrocious, really. But at the same time, what did we learn?
Right. And we have to think about it today. We're not immune from that today. And I know of unfortunate stories that have happened today. And I hate those stories. We're working with society's most vulnerable population. And we should be extra mindful of the things that we're doing and saying, and yet it continues to happen.
Yeah, absolutely.
I hate that.
We still have major systemic issues in our mental health treatments in Australia.
Yes. Same in the States. And I wonder, I'm sure we're not the only two countries in the world struggling with that by any means. And
no, so, we're probably some of the more advanced too.
Right.
Which is scary.
Yeah. And so it really falls on us to see what we can do better, what we can do differently. And I always try to think, you know, 50 years in the future, what are we going to look back on today and say, I can't believe we used to do that in our treatment. And
that's a very interesting point. We have in Ballarat, I drive past it all the time. We have an 1890s building, so it looks older, but it is still the psych services building of Ballarat. And I'm looking at it thinking, man, in 150 years, someone like me is going to come along and they're going to do a ghost tour in that building.
Oh, yeah. And to think that's where, you know, where we or contemporary folks are going for treatment now, and how much better can it be and should it be for folks?
Yeah, but it's also tied down by resources and money, isn't it? And that's the scary thing, is that it can be a bit of a bottomless pit, because a lot of people who are suffering from mental illness require funding and need, because they aren't able to be productive.
Absolutely.
And so, yeah, you know, you have to go, oh, well, resources are finite. How much do we allocate to any societal need, I guess? But, yeah, there are certainly ways we can do things better.
Yeah. And, you know, of course, we know even today, and then history shows us this as well, that, you know, when we're talking about mental illness treatment, the folks on the lower end of the socioeconomic spectrum are going to fall through the cracks more often because they lack the resources and the access to those services. Whereas folks who have more money, who have more access to services, they're going to get their treatment just fine. So we end up seeing, at least where I am and where I work, we see this revolving door of poverty, really, of folks who are just going through the system because they have to steal to survive, and then they get arrested and they go through the cycle, and it seems never ending at times.
I was just watching a documentary last night on situation in an American town and the fentanyl issue. And we don't have such a fentanyl issue in Australia, but we do have methamphetamine, crystal meth or ice. Mm-hmm. And poverty and mental illness and drug use mixed in at the same time, this is a problem.
It is. And I had a patient a couple years ago who was able to discharge from the hospital, and then we learned not too long ago, overdosed and died on fentanyl, intentionally or unintentionally. It doesn't really matter. And I just hate those stories. You know, I hate them because it's become such a problem. And I try to do my best to tell my current patients, like, this was somebody that you knew, this was somebody that you lived with for a long time, and nobody is immune to this problem. And it is such a problem.
Mm-hmm. These days, I mean, in the 1800s, when they were building lunatic asylums, they weren't all, I mean, they were dealing with alcoholism. And one of the big things in the early days of Aradale was moonshine was causing a lot of mental illnesses, because they were drinking, and I'll make sure if I get this right for your listeners, methanol and not ethanol. Okay. And that causes problems because they were producing it properly. I mean, these days we've got drug-induced psychosis, and that's a totally different issue again.
Yes, absolutely. And sometimes it's hard to parse out the difference between what is a genuine organic psychosis and what is a drug-induced psychosis. I worked in the emergency rooms for a couple of years, and it was nearly impossible to tell when somebody came in if they were high on meth, and having delusions and hallucinations. And I wasn't sure, you know, in that moment, were they actually experiencing genuine psychosis, or was this just the natural consequence of using these substances? It's hard to tell.
Very hard to tell. And yeah, it is a big problem that we do have to come up with good conclusions for. It's a very hard question. Anyway, let's go back to Aradale and go, shall we?
I was just thinking the same thing. That's all right. Yes. I feel like we could talk about this forever.
Yes.
So going back to Aradale, I know you mentioned this, it was a great site. You know, it had all of the aesthetic values that you were looking for, the cobwebs, the overall creepiness. What do you find particularly special about the site?
There's so much. I mean, I'm an historian and the history blows me away. And as an historian, it was relatively late in my career that I even became aware that there were lunatic asylums in Australia. It's not something that featured on my, in my brain, and it's not something that is ingrained in the Australian national identity. Australian history is based around convicts. And, you know, we've got prisons galore everywhere. Everyone knows about our convict history. But when I first went on the Beechworth Ghost Tour, Beechworth is the sister asylum of Arrowdale, I was absolutely blown away because I had no notion up until that point that Australia had lunatic asylums. Beechworth is maybe two-thirds of the size of Arrowdale, maybe a little bit half, maybe half the size. So when I first saw Arrowdale, I knew, oh, that's something really special. Beechworth was already a very, very busy ghost tour. The architecture of Arrowdale is, and it's something that I hear all the time from customers, is that it is such a sad story in such a beautiful building. And it is, just, I love walking around it. And it's an honor to be able to help the future of this building by showing people around now. You know, these buildings fall over unless we do something with them.
Right. And it keeps
it is one of the most beautiful, it is one of the most beautiful buildings in Australia. Absolutely. It's also one of the most scary and horrific buildings in Australia, but it definitely has both sides of the coin.
Absolutely. And I always emphasize that both things can be true at the same time. You know, a lot of the old, in the States, the old Kirkbride buildings were absolutely stunningly beautiful and just architectural masterpieces. And at the same time, some absolutely horrific things went on there.
And that's something I say to my customers, is that we look at the behavior of the psychiatrists and the attendants of the asylum in the 1800s with horror. And absolutely there were horrors going on, and we know that there were beatings and mistreatment and sexual abuse. We know all of that was going on. But there is the other side of the coin, where there's these huge, beautiful, expensive edifices that the government have created and poured resources into, and the alternative was a life on the streets. And they have to be acknowledged that the government was trying something.
Absolutely. Right. And I don't know if you had a chance to listen to the last episode on Q Asylum, but there was this time when these buildings were constructed that they were really symbols of pride. You know, we had arrived,
yes,
understood psychiatric treatment, and they were sort of the physical proof and physical manifestation of, look, we understand how to treat this now, and we know what to do. Of course, we know now that's far from the truth, but at least at the time, it was something that really stood out as a representation of how far they'd come.
Absolutely. The Beechworth Asylum was called for decades, it was called the Lion of Beechworth, because they were so proud of it. It was such a state-of-the-art, cutting-edge facility that no other town had, and it created work, and they were proud of it.
Yeah. I mean, as they should have been at the time. And it's interesting how quickly that turned. And thinking of the history of Q, it was less than 10 years after it was built that they went, maybe this wasn't the best idea ever.
Yeah,
maybe
yeah.
Maybe we should have done something different.
That you did touch upon that in your talk on J-Ward. And one thing that we discussed at Arrowdale on my tour and was a source of inspiration for me when writing was the Zox report from Zox, which we did mention along the way.
Yes.
1880, I don't know if I get my dates right, it's 1884, is it? I thought 86 they intervene or something, somewhere mid-1860s.
Yeah.
and that was a pivotal point.
Absolutely.
Zox came out and said, hang on, we've got these massive institutions, these big edifices. And that was 20 years after they opened, and he came out and said, these are already out of date, philosophically unsound, but we have spent the money, so we will continue to use them.
Right. But maybe let's separate some folks, you know, that we know shouldn't be with the general public who has mental illness. And I think I went into, we had the same, I'm sure this is true at multiple hospitals, but I focused on it in Airedale and Q and then Oregon State Hospital, where just everybody was mixed in together. And I cannot imagine for the most vulnerable among those folks how scary that must have been. And then for anybody who even had an ounce of manipulation in them, that was a really, could have been an easy way to take advantage of other people. And just, it's hard to even think about.
Absolutely. I make points of saying that on my, we have a number of tours at Arrowdale because it's such a huge site. I can get 7 tours in the building at the same time and they don't know that there's another tour on site.
Oh, wow.
And so it's that big. And I make the point in my four-hour tour, people like to actually go out there and go for 4 hours, which is fine with me because I can talk about it for that long. But every Sunday night we have a ghost tour that goes for 4 hours as well as our regular two-hour tour. But I do make the point on the longer tour that, you know, up until that stage, 1886, you would be having four-year-old children in there with Down syndrome in the same walking yard as serial killer.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that no one cared. No one even bothered to point this out.
Yeah. And it's just so awful to think about it, you know, and chances are that four-year-old child was essentially abandoned by their family. And to think of how scary that must have been.
Absolutely. And that's a really sad thing because
yeah.
In Arrowdale, there was a procedure for committal.
Mm-hmm.
And we see that regularly being abused. And that can be either in the form of, like, say, the husband has got a 40-year-old wife who is suffering from postnatal depression because it's the 1800s and she's got 6 kids. Mm-hmm. It only took 2 signatures to get in. One of them could be the policeman. You know, you just get your wife sent to the asylum committed for hysteria.
Yeah.
Go and get a nice new young wife. That happened all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And then a lot of those women who were, you know, committed for things like made up disease like hysteria were actually useful in the asylum because they could help the nurses look after the patients who actually really needed help. Mm-hmm. And because they were useful, they were less likely to be released.
Yeah.
So it was a circular issue for that.
Absolutely. Oh my gosh. And then just, we know a lot. And again, not just Arrowdale, but in other hospitals, the patient worker exploitation was just rampant. You know, they could, if they had somebody essentially captive there who wasn't going anywhere, they could use them in the laundry room. They could use them to make whatever products they were making and they wouldn't have to pay them. It saved the hospital a whole lot of money at their expense. And they just tacked it on as another form of therapy.
Yeah, that's right. And we had problems with that at Arrowdale because when the asylum opened, it was designed around a huge farm, and the theory was that the lunatics, use the term correctly, would work the farm and create the food, and this would keep the cost of the asylum down and give the lunatics something to do during the day and give them fresh air and sunlight. And it's, you can see that there's absolute benefits to that. But 100 years later, the government shuts down most of the farm because the philosophy has changed, and now that we're seeing as slave labor.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And it's sort of double-edged.
Then you get them, you know, like after that, they shut the farm down, you get a worse situation, which is very one flew over the cuckoo's nest, where instead of being out on the farm, getting sun and farming, they're just locked away in halls playing cards.
Absolutely. And that, you know, I see, you know, right now we have kind of a nice option that we have for our patients at my hospital where they're able to work and they do get paid for their work. But I do see that the work is very beneficial for them. It's really seen, the work is seen as a privilege, and it's really easy to lose if they get in trouble. But they're also being paid. And so they're not being necessarily exploited. And so I think that was really what was missing from it, because the intent was really good of getting people out, getting them active, you know, just getting them outdoors and doing something that would be fulfilling and meaningful. That's really powerful and very therapeutic. But if we're just using them for their labor in order to save money, that causes other problems.
Well, that's right. Yeah. Arrowdale, as you saw in the police report from the 1980s, there were a lot of accusations of a lot of pilfering.
Yeah.
But then, you know, government institutions, I used to work in the education department, and I saw a lot of pilfering. So I think that's just government departments, really. I've been told that by former staff, yes, there was a lot of pilfering going on, but then there's also an attitude in the government that a lot of that, or in the town rather, that a lot of that was dug up as an excuse to shut it down.
Yeah.
But I'm not so sure. I think psychiatric philosophy had changed, and that was the reason why it was shut down.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it sounds like, I mean, it's always a complex issue, and there's always multiple things happening at once, and it just kind of grows and accumulates until it shuts down. But, you know, yes, money factors in, political changes factor in, recognizing the problems, the systemic problems factors in, all sorts of things. So thinking about the ghost tour itself, because I'm so fascinated about what you do on this tour. If somebody's ever been on the tour, what should they expect?
All right. So it's a night time. It's always a night. We are absolutely playing on the atmosphere of the building. I'm just going to describe the 2-hour tour for you at the moment, because I told you we've got a number of other products up there. But the 2-hour is the most popular. And that's Friday and Saturday night. And we'll have maybe 3 or 4 go out over a night. They'll have up to 30 people on them.
Wow.
And it goes for 2 hours, and it takes you on a big walk, a circular walk through Arrowdale, starting and finishing at the front door. And along the way, we go into the administration, laying the groundwork of the history of the asylum. Why is it there? Who was there? How is it being run? And as we progress through the female ward, we start to get less away from the administrative side, more into the lifestyle of the patients, start to hit on treatments, hitting on ghosts along the way, because at first we had to go, okay, well, where are we going to get our ghosts from? So we started to ask the community around us, and people started to come forward and give us ghost stories. But the script has changed a lot over the 12 years, because we've had so many people through now. I think, honestly, in 12 years we've had about 100,000 through.
Wow.
And that's a lot of ghost stories on top of the ones that we started with. And our staff have all their, and we have paranormal investigation tours. They have stuff happen to them as well. So our script is changing, but our history is usually fairly consistent. But we do change our ghost stories up a fair bit, because someone will be driving home that night and something really crazy happened to them that night. And so, that's a good story. We'll put that in. So the script is changing and evolving, but we hit the main sections, the both of the male and the female wards. The male ward, I think, is the creepiest building in Australia, hands down.
Wow.
Yeah, hands down. I've been on every single ghost tour in Australia, and don't tell your listeners this one, but I've managed to, one way or the other, gain access to every single lunatic asylum in Australia.
Oh, my goodness. I'm so jealous.
Yeah, there were a few fences jumped there, but when I say not functioning psychiatric institutes, I'm talking lunatic asylums, you know.
Okay.
Yeah, not the new ones. No, we're not going to go there. So I've seen them, and the men's hospital, and I've done ghost tours all over the world. I go overseas every year going on ghost tours. The men's hospital, the men's ward, is one of the creepiest buildings I have ever encountered in my life, and the creepiest building in Australia. It is big. It is dark. It stinks. It is 3 stories. It's labyrinthine. It is so easy to get lost. And the darkness is just coming at you from every direction.
Oh, my
God. And then you've got someone like me sitting there explaining to you the history of the serial killer that was in that cell, and people are just freaking out.
Yeah.
We have a mortuary on site. You know, I estimate over 10,000 people, I say safely, over 10,000 people died at Arrowdale. We take you into the original mortuary there. We have the kitchens. We do have an underground section. So that takes 2 hours to walk around it. And then people liked it so much that we wanted to do sleepovers. So we were doing sleepovers for a while. And yeah, we used to. It was fantastic. But the government and OHS, particularly in Victoria, there's so many loopholes to jump through that we had to stop doing the sleepover.
I can imagine that caused some problems.
Yeah, just OHS issues, which were easy to overcome, but just paperwork, which is frustrating, of course. But we do four-hour tours around the site as well, four-hour ghost tour, and that gives us time to walk around and discuss a little bit more at leisure. But there's, when Aradar shut down, there were 62 buildings there.
Oh my
there's goodness. Still 58, I think, on Google Maps. I counted 58. Okay. So, I mean, it took me 3 months to see Aradale to say that I'd seen in every room.
Wow.
And then every now and then I'd bump into a room and go, oh, hang on, I think this is a new room. So 4 hours is everyone is run ragged and exhausted, but by no means have we exhausted the site.
And structurally, is everything still sound? Are there any places that are having issues or, you know, substandard in terms of the structure itself or...?
The actual original 1860 structure is so remarkably strong and well built. You're always going to have maintenance issues. Like, it's got a shale roof and we get a heavy storm come through and the shale will shift and then we get leaks. So we've got drones going over the top of it with workmen up there regularly. And, you know, the maintenance cost on that is costing the government. My rent doesn't even come close just to covering the maintenance cost on this building, which is really sad.
Yeah.
But at the same time, you know, we're in a catch-22 position. Is someone going to buy Aradale and turn it into something? And I'm like, no, I don't think they are.
Because right.
I couldn't imagine anyone spending the money. But the maintenance cost in the meantime, you know, nothing lasts forever. But we've got good heritage laws in Australia that prevent or protect old buildings. But frequently they get sort of forgotten along the way as well. So it's a constant sure.
Yeah, and I asked because I'm thinking particularly of Oregon State Hospital. It was rebuilt a little over 10 years ago now, but it got to a point where the structure was so unsound that they just started closing off entire wards and just saying we don't go in there anymore. And that's a problem too.
Yeah, well, we've had things like, you know, a couple. We actually have been shut down by the government twice because of OHS concerns. In the 12 years, the first one was because it was still listed on paper as a hospital, and hospitals have emergency exit lights and wired smoke alarms to the fire department, and that system had fallen over 10 years ago. And so they go, "Oh, you can't. There's no smoke alarm in there." And someone else was smoking in there. So it took a while to get it open again. But it was an issue.
Yeah.
Then they found that there was lead contamination on site because they used lead paint on the building and that was leaking into the ground. And then we had to go and get blood tests and, you know, we're all fine. So, you know, these are the realities of dealing with 1800s buildings.
Absolutely. And who knows what else could be hanging out in there as well. So,
touch wood.
You mentioned, I mean, on the two-hour tour, you kind of run the gamut as going around and seeing some of the creepy highlight places. What are some of the main stories that you tell folks when they do come through the tour?
We lay down, first of all, why it's there, who built it, what it was for, who it was for. Like you've discussed in your other podcasts, we break down psychiatric concepts. Like the DSM now, I can't remember how many mental illnesses are in the DSM now. They keep to be adding them every day. But 1860, there were four. And so each stop we sort of go to, the way I've sort of formulated, and there is a formula, we will go to a spot, I will explain the history of that spot, and then I will give some personal detail or some treatment history, and then there's generally a ghost story connected to that spot. So walking around, we talk about, you know, I'm trying to think about it in order. Starting in the female ward, we talk about the women, the way they work. Then we'll go into the kitchens and talk about how the kitchens work and the halls and different treatments. And then we go into the hospitals and start to talk about lobotomies and drug therapy. And then down to the mortuary, where we just engage in letting our morbid curiosities run wild, talking about death. We get someone up on the table and talk about autopsy and describe it to them. And, you know, it's gross, but people are fascinated by it. And that's it, because the dark tourism is the tourism of death, and people want to get as close to it as possible without experiencing it. And the mortuary is absolutely one of our favourite spots on the tour. I personally think it's one of the least impressive. It's just a small mortuary, but everyone has to see it.
Right, right. There's something that kind of sticks out about that. I mean, a lot of people talk about the sort of fad of true crime interest. I'm like, this isn't a fad. This is something that people have always been interested in.
Absolutely. You know, I've had people, and I'm probably a bit sick because I'm doing this job at the moment, but I also look at how many people are rocking up, and I think we are all living vicariously through other people's deaths. And I think we have to, because that's how we learn about death. And by learning about death, we learn about life.
Right. Yes, absolutely. We can see that actually in a lot of the history of the founders of psychology. We learn about their backgrounds, and a lot of it is their interaction with death. And that's how they came to their psychological theories. And that's what the current field is built upon.
Yeah, absolutely. And I look at these asylums now, and the mortuary on site at all of these asylums in Victoria is it's out the back. You know, it's not one of the most predominant buildings, but if you were there as a patient, you would have been able to freely walk past the mortuary every single day, seeing your friends being wheeled in and out of there, knowing that that's your end of days.
Yeah.
And it was so in their face. Like, we've removed, I couldn't imagine if we were to go back to an asylum system that we would have mortuaries on site like these buildings do.
Right. I don't think we do, at least not in California anymore. At Oregon State Hospital, until the new hospital was built, there was still the crematorium on site with the big smokestack that was striped like a barbershop pole. You know, it was red and white, and you could see it all around town. And just, it was such a visceral reminder of what happened. And I was very glad when they got rid of that, because it was so disturbing.
Yeah, yeah, that is really disturbing, isn't it? But, you know, I guess it's we have always treated our mentally ill as second class.
Yeah, unfortunately.
Mm. Yeah. And we still do.
We still do. And that actually sort of leads me into my next question of, you know, one of the things I brought up in a recent episode was there's sort of this balancing game between the day tours and the night tours of talking about the very real things that happen there and sort of making it palatable for families and for visitors. But then there's also, you know, there's the very real reality of the horrors that went on there. And I'm just curious how you balance that in your particular tour, knowing that if we actually talked about all of the realities that happened there, it might scare people away.
Yeah. I understand. And it is that fine balance. And so I will talk freely at length about lobotomies and straitjackets, because there's a high probability that no one in the room is going to be triggered by me talking about that. One thing that I could talk about at Arendelle ad nauseum and stay away from almost completely is sexual abuse, because I know that can be such a trigger. Yeah. It's not that I'm not acknowledging that it wasn't an enormous factor on the tour. And if I was probably less concerned about the potential reaction of some audience members, I could bring up some really horrific stories.
Right.
But you just don't know who's on the tour and what that's going to trigger. And sex is just that little bit more of a tricky subject than violence, which is strange.
And there's we're more removed from lobotomies. It's easier to look back at lobotomies and say, this is something that used to happen. Whereas we know sexual abuse is ongoing and is very real in many people's lives. The chances are, I hope nobody on the tour has ever had a lobotomy or experienced a lobotomy.
No. Not that I know of. But I do remember very early on, we had the groundskeeper, bless his soul. He had been the groundskeeper there for years. And when we started up the asylum tour, he was a bit, he couldn't stop us. I think he originally wasn't particularly impressed that we were going to turn into a tourism attraction, but he did warm to it. But a couple of weeks after we'd started, he wanted to know what we were doing. And we're like, okay, we'll come and have a look. And he brought his great nephew or his nephew, who actually was a former patient.
Oh, wow.
And I'm like, oh, man, here I am. I'm going to be using the word lunatic for the next 2 hours. I'm going to be using it without any reservation or remorse. And, in fact, for the purposes of theatricalism, I'm going to be milking this word in front of a former patient. And that's why our history has to be so accurate, because you don't know who's going to be on that tour. But that former patient loved what we were doing. And I don't know why he was a patient or of his condition and to in relation to his cognitive level. But he thoroughly enjoyed it, which for me was good, because I'm like, okay, if I can have a former patient in here and talk about this and he's enjoyed it, then I can have anyone here and talk about it and not worry too much about their reaction. Says perhaps more about them than says more what it says about us.
Right.
So, yeah,
it's difficult because there are so many things that could be triggering to folks, but there is sort of an inherent, if you're going on this tour and you have even a vague sense of what happened at these old hospitals, you sort of know what you're getting yourself into.
That's right. You know, yeah. I mean, don't, if you're sensitive and nervous type, don't go on a ghost tour in a big lunatic asylum. You know, that's kind of like, if you get too scared, well, what do you expect? We're not going to hold back. My market is not kids. My goal is to be the scariest, creepiest ghost tour in the country, because that's how you measure the success of a ghost tour. Is it scary or not?
Yeah.
And so I want it to be the best. So I want to have the creepiest stories. But, yeah, again, it's the difference between creeping someone out and triggering them. And I guess that you keep away from events that they may be able to relate to themselves.
Yeah, that makes sense to me. Yeah. So one of the questions that I wanted to ask was, you know, I know you've listened to the series on Airedale, and obviously even in a multi-part series, there's only so much that I can convey. And are there any major stories, really important stories that I may have missed, or that I may have maybe unintentionally misrepresented? I'm curious if there were any big holes in my research that...
No, I have to say, the first episode I was listening to, I was incredibly impressed. And I reached out to you and we've been chatting since, because it was like listening to my script. I was, wow, you have done such an amazing job of research.
Oh, thank you.
One thing, yeah, you're most welcome. And I've been studying this building for 12 years now and talking to a lot of people, and your research and knowledge was, and your representation of it was magnificent. One thing I thought was interesting that in your first, because you did four episodes on Airedale and then you did one on Jay Ward.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that it was that you may have missed the Zox report, but then you brought it up in episode 5 in discussing Airedale. And I'm like, well, if you've got that in, you were talking about stuff that, you know, stuff that I was aware of, but stuff that I don't cover on tour, like the 1980s police report, because there are people in the community related to and involved with that. And so for us, I guess the clearest way to avoid offending people who may be connected is we try and keep as much of the history as possible to the 1800s. The names of patients, if we mention any names of patients, I don't mention any patients' names. I mention a couple of superintendents' names because they're major characters and can go and look them up, and I don't disrespect them at all. But names are almost irrelevant. 1800s history is hard to be offended by, and you really painted the whole story really well.
Oh, good. I was really nervous when I first started, and I was putting together the timeline, because generally what I do when I'm putting these together is I actually draw out a timeline of events so that I can go chronologically. That's how my brain works. Yeah. And I was looking at the Zox report and thinking, I probably should have included it in the episode on Airedale, but I thought, well, you know I'm going to work on Jay Ward later and it seems more pertinent then. But then I did end up coming back to it in the episode on Q and saying, well, this was at a significant moment in history. So I probably, you know, going back, I probably would have included that in, but I'm also glad that it did get mentioned in the Jay Ward episode.
Yeah, it is an important document. But I guess your asylum history and our asylum history would be similar in that I divide Airedale into four stages that you would be familiar with the American systems. I say it's a lunatic asylum, and then it's a mental hospital, and then it's a lunatic asylum, then it's a hospital for the insane, then it's a mental hospital, and then it's a psychiatric hospital, and then it closed. Four stages. And your timings would be similar. You might be give or take a year or so, but American and English and Australian psychiatry do seem to follow patterns fairly quickly with each other.
Yes. I noticed that when I was going through, it just seemed some of the years match up perfectly. And So there was that same, there everybody's learning from each other and seeing, hey, what is this country doing now? Oh, they're moving forward. Let's follow them. And it'll be interesting. I do hope to look into some other areas. I have one in mind from South Korea that they'll be upcoming, not probably anytime soon, but it'll be interesting to see how that follows or doesn't follow that sort of pattern that we see, at least in the English-speaking world.
Yeah, that's an interesting thing, is the way other cultures deal with them as well. It's fascinating subjects.
Yeah, absolutely. So let's see, sort of last question. What do you take away from your work at Airedale? Like, what gives it meaning to you?
I think I have the best job in the world. I get to show people around this enormous, beautiful, horrific building. I get to affect their emotional response. I trigger. I get people laughing. I get people crying. I get people fainting in fear. I get a whole gamut of reactions. But one thing that I love is that I get reactions. I get strong reactions, and that means that we're doing something right, and that in itself is an honor. And to be able to say, okay, this building was here in 1867 and we're here in 2023, and perhaps the work that I am doing now will mean that that building is still there at the turn of the next century, and people are still learning about the history of mental illness in Australia.
Yeah.
And that's I don't want to see the building fall down. It's an incredible building, and so many have been lost, and they are rare and valuable and beautiful, and my life's work is to give that building as much purpose as possible so that the person who's going to come along when I can't anymore can take it to the next level.
Mm-hmm. And I appreciate what you said at the very beginning about, this is how we honor the folks who did stay there. You know, there were many people who should not have been there, and many people who, did meet the criteria to be there, and their lives are worth remembering and are worth honoring.
I'm going to finish now with a final story for you and your listeners. Okay. It was echoing what you've just said, and it was a beautiful example. One night I was doing a tour up at Airedale, and there's a woman there, must have been in her 50s, and we were in one of the cells, and there were about 20 people on tour, and halfway through my story, she pulled out a bag of rose petals and started scattering them on the floor of the cell. And so I said, that's interesting, you're right, what are you up to there? And she said, oh, my mother died in Airedale. I don't know which cell she died in. I never got to say goodbye to her. So I've come out on the tour. We are in a cell, and I'm bringing her flowers and leaving them in the closest place that I know was to where she spent the last several years of her life.
Oh.
And I just looked at her and I said, go for it. Put as many rose petals down as you want. And I ordered the staff to leave them there, and eventually, after about a year or so, we had to get rid of them, but I wanted them there because it was important. The woman wouldn't have been able to come in and do that if we hadn't opened the door for her.
Oh, wow. That must have been so special and meaningful for her.
And us.
Yeah, for sure. Oh, my goodness. Thank you for sharing that.
Yeah.
Well, is there anything else that you'd like to say about the tour or about Airedale before we let you go?
Well, to any of your listeners who haven't come and had a look at it yet, hurry up.
Where can they find you? Do you have any website should they look for?
www.eerietours, eerietours.com.au, or a simple Airedale Ghost Tour search on Google, bring it up.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much. Thank you. I really appreciate you being here and talking about all the work that you're doing at Airedale. It's a perfect way to wrap up this particular series before we move on to our next hospital.
Thank you very much for your time.
Yes. And just as always, thank you for listening. Thank you for your participation. And all, as always, remember the words of Maya Angelou, do the best you can until you know better. And then when you know better, do better. Until next time.
Thank you so much for listening to Behind the Walls of the World Psychiatric Hospitals. Once again, I'm your host, Dr. Sarah Gallup. Cover image is by Christopher Payne. Check out my website at behindthewallspodcast.buzzsprout.com. Follow the podcast and learn more on Facebook at Behind the Walls Podcast and Instagram at Behind the Walls Pod. For questions or recommendations, email me at behindthewallspodcast@gmail.com. You can find new episodes every Monday on Amazon Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you're listening right now. If you like the show, please rate, review, and subscribe on Apple Podcasts. It helps other people find and listen to the show, and I would be so grateful. Please stay tuned for more episodes of Behind the Walls of the World Psychiatric Hospitals. Until next time.